Okay, the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. It's February 12th, 2013. Oh, that's cheese is strong. That's on the tape.
Who's the vice chair?
The first thing we need to do is approve the prior commission meetings. Why don't we take that in one motion? Senator Murphy, I think you were at both committee meetings, August 24th and January 29th.
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of the August 24th and January 29th minutes as printed.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, tonight is kind of pensions 101. And as we, since so many of us are new to the Pension Commission, so many of you are new to the Pension Commission, so as you look at your agenda, we're going to be hearing from several different presenters, and I've asked them to try to keep their presentation at a pretty basic level so we get the basic terminology and the basic concepts down, because we'll be coming back to these again and again in the future. And hopefully we'll be done in about an hour tonight, because I know people want to run home and watch the State of the State. Especially the Republicans.
It's going to be the State of the Union.
State of the State?
State of the Union. State of the Union.
Yeah.
I kept getting those mixed up. We already watched the State of the State. So I'd like to welcome, first of all, to the commission, Benita Wurst from Gabriel Roeder Smith and Company, the actuary. Welcome to the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the commission. It's nice to be here. We're going to start out your Pension 101 night with actuarial basics. I'm an actuary. I've worked with public retirement plans in Minnesota for more than 20 years, and I work out of the Minneapolis office, so I'm happy to be here tonight. So the presentation I prepared is brief, and there, Lisa says that there are hard copies available and in your packets. So we'll work through a slide at a time. So beginning with slide two, all public employee retirement systems typically have common funding objectives, and they include something called intergenerational equity. And in a nutshell, what that means is that there's a desire to have the costs of the pension plan align with the benefits of the people who are earning them during the time that they are earning them. An example where intergenerational equity is not achieved is if a generation gets a valuable benefit that is not being paid for during their career, and then the cost of that is shifted to a future generation. So we want to avoid that. Another goal is a stable pattern of contribution rates. That kind of speaks for itself. If you have volatile contributions or steadily increasing contributions, that's a harder challenge to fund. And then in general, pension plans are targeting a 100% funding ratio, or a ratio of assets and liabilities equal to 100%. And what that really means is that you have enough assets in the plan's fund to fund 100% of the liabilities. If you're not at 100% today, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but the actuary is going to work out some kind of contribution that will get you heading towards 100%. And in Minnesota, in the statutes, each plan does have a statutory amortization date, and the goal is that the contributions will allow that plan to achieve full funding by whatever date is in the statutes. And typically right now, those dates are 20 to 30 years in the future. On slide three, we indicate several things that are needed in order to meet those funding objectives that we just went over. First, there needs to be a reasonable forecast of resources and obligations. We're projecting what the plan needs into the future for a very long period of time. And so what that depends on is good assumptions, actuarial assumptions, because we're making a lot of forecasts and expectations about what will happen in the future. We'll talk a little bit more about assumptions because it's an important part of an actuary's work. Because experience is not smooth, there are some devices that we can use to smooth the experience in the plan. Many of you are probably aware that investment gains and losses are smoothed over a 5-year period. And that's because we know that the investment market is volatile, but we don't necessarily want your contributions to be volatile. So there's some short-term smoothing that helps you achieve the long-term objective. And then the contributions are established so that if everything works out, they will remain level as a percent of pay. And that is another kind of smoothing. Two other things that are needed to meet objectives are a sound funding program and a sound investment program. And I believe Mr. Bicker's on the agenda to talk about the sound investment program. But by sound funding program, what we really mean is that in order to meet your objectives, you have to make the contributions that will allow you to meet your objectives. So if we're recommending a certain level of contribution and there's a prolonged period of time where those contributions are not made, then you won't be on track to meet your goal and your contributions will not be stable. So even though actuaries have a rap of making everything extremely complicated, on page 4 we want to boil it down to the basic retirement funding equation, which is really very simple. And it says money in equals money out. Money in, your sources of money in are contributions and investment returns. And money out will simply be benefits that are being paid from the fund and expenses. And so in the long run, at the end of the day, those two sides must be equal. Money in will equal money out. But what we spend all of our energy doing is trying to predict what those benefits are, predict what that investment income is, so that we can keep it in balance today and then adjust as you move forward. A little bit more on slide 5 about the basic funding equation. Again, they always have to be equal. So if, for example, investment return suffers and you have a decrease on the money inside of the equation, then in order to keep it in balance, you could increase contributions, you could decrease benefits, or you could decrease expenses, something to keep it level over the long run. B, which is benefits paid, depends on the provisions of the plan. What's the formula? What is the benefit that a retiree from the plan will receive, and those are fixed and known. But it also depends on experience. For example, how old will each retiree be when they retire? What will their pay be? How much service will they have? Which form of payment will they elect? Do they have a spouse? How long will that benefit be paid? And that's really where assumptions come into play, because we're looking at the life of the plan and making predictions 80 years into the future about what those benefits will be paid, and it takes into account all of those components that we mentioned. So B really depends on plan provisions and experience. And C, which is contributions, in the short term will depend on your assumptions and your cost method, your current assets to your liability ratio, and things like that. But in the long term, according to the equation, the contributions needed will really always be reflective of the other three components: investment return, benefits, and expenses. They're always going to balance. So when one goes up or down, something else must go up or down eventually. If you run out of money, you can't pay the benefits. For example. Okay, moving on to slide 6. This shows the typical pattern of a pension plan over its lifetime. So beginning at the lower left, at the very day one of a pension plan, nobody's earned any service, nobody's receiving any benefits, but they're starting to earn those. So the green line represents benefits paid from a pension plan over its life. So a few years in, you will have retirees, you will be paying benefit payments. And the trend of that green line is very sharp. It goes up very fast as you get more and more retirees and those benefit payments basically compound. And after 50 or so years, we would finally see that benefit payment trend line start to stabilize. And that's when a plan becomes mature and we start to see kind of an even flow of new retirees offset by deaths of people who have been retired and have older ages. I want to point out that the scale there isn't dollars, but it's percent of active payroll, because we do recognize that there's inflation over time. So one approach to funding would be to pay as you go, and just when a benefit payment is paid or due, you fund it at the time. So in year one, it might be $1 million. In year two, it might be $4 million. And you can see by the trend of that green line that the costs would rapidly escalate and then stabilize many, many years down the road at a certain level percent of pay. There isn't an asset pool in this example. You would just be paying the benefit payments as they are paid. So it tracks somewhat to our Social Security system. And in Minnesota, there are a couple of funds that are pay-as-you-go funded, and that includes the elective state officers and the legislators' plans. Both of those were closed some years ago and are relatively small, but they are being funded on a pay-as-you-go basis. The judge's plan used to be funded on a pay-as-you-go basis, but 20, 30 years ago was switched to a funding level that would be more stable and build an asset base to offset the ever-increasing benefit payments. So to contrast the pay-as-you-go method on slide 7, we show something that is more of a long-term solution to the equation. So the green line is the same. That's the pay-as-you-go cost. But the level, the straight red bar represents a level contribution rate that in theory could build up enough asset base and investment income to fund the benefits for the lifetime of the plan. So in the early years, to the left of the green line, you'll be funding more than what your benefit payments are, what they are requiring. And you're doing that to build up an asset base. And when you have an asset base, you have the potential for investment earnings. So most of your plans live right now on the right side of the green line, which means that the contributions that are coming in are less than the benefits that are being paid, and what's making up the difference is the investment earnings on the millions and billions of dollars in the fund that have been built up over the year. So you pay more than you need in the early years, but you ultimately can have a contribution rate that is level, that is stable, and that has a much lower ultimate level than the green line, because we do see that the green line stabilizes, but at a much higher rate than the red line. And so the actuarial theory of funding is to set up a level contribution rate that will take advantage of assets in the bank and investment earnings in order to achieve a level contribution amount that is offset quite a bit by investment returns.
Members, feel free to ask questions. Senator Lesch. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Representative.
Knew that didn't sound right.
Ms. Wurst, you spoke of the contributions as a lump employer-employee contributions. What are the benefits and liabilities of having a higher or lower employee contribution vis-a-vis an employer contribution?
Ms. Wurst.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, we on the funding side of things, we focus on how much money is the plan receiving, and so we don't break it out on the funding side of things. But a difference between the employee contributions and the employer contributions is that the employee contributions accumulate with interest and can potentially be refunded to those members in lieu of a retirement benefit. And typically that happens when somebody doesn't stay in the system long enough to retire. So when the employees, so there is a benefit associated with employee contributions that adds a little bit to the liability. It's not as significant as a retirement benefit, an annuity paid for life. But if you were to shift contributions from the employer to the employee, you'd also increase the benefit cost of the plan a little bit when you did that.
Understood. Thank you.
Why don't you proceed with your presentation?
Thank you. Okay, picking it up on slide 8, we just have a couple of slides to hopefully drive home some of the points. So on slide 8, we ask the question, which plan would you rather retire from? The funding ratio in 2013 for both Plan 1 and Plan 2 is 60%. And so in theory, they're on equal footing. You could retire from either and be treated the same. But if we look backwards, we can see that 10 years ago, Plan 1 was 30% funded, and it has trended upward every year consistently to a 60% funded ratio. And Plan 2 was 90% funded 10 years ago and has trended downward, and it's now sitting at 60%. And so when I look at this and say, which plan would I rather retire from, I'm looking at the trend. And it looks to me like Plan 2 is spending down its assets, and the contributions are probably not sufficient or the assumptions aren't correct. But it appears that Plan 2 is on a downward trend and that the contributions are not sufficient to keep it going, whereas Plan 1 is not spending down its assets. It is building the funding ratio and in theory would reach a 80%, 90%, 100% funding ratio if the trend continued. So as actuaries, we always present kind of flat snapshot data, but we also are interested in looking at it from kind of other dimensions. And on slide 9, again, we have a sample Plan 1 and a sample Plan 2. Plan 1 is 90% funded and has a required contribution rate of 10% of pay. And what that represents is the contribution that the actuaries have calculated in order for the plan to reach 100% funding by its statutory amortization date.
And that's a mix of employer-employee?
Yes, it is. It's basically saying, here's the bill. We don't care how you pay it. So 10% of pay is what the actuary has calculated as the required rate. The statutory contributions is what you're actually collecting, and that typically is where it's a blend of employer and employee.
Okay.
So it might be 4% member, 4% employer. And these are simple numbers. They don't represent any of the plans that you're responsible for. But when we compare the two, Plan 1 is not taking in as much as required, and so there's a contribution deficiency of 2% of pay. Plan 2 is only 60% funded, and again has a required rate of 10%, but is taking in 11% of pay. And when we look at that, we say that the contribution is sufficient by 1% of pay. And so which plan would you want to retire from? One of them is healthy at 90% today, but it looks like it is not funded appropriately enough to maintain the 90% or to improve the 90%. So I would expect, with all other things being equal, that the 90% would trend downward in the future unless the contributions or the benefits are adjusted or it has very good experience, which we can't count on. Plan 2 is at 60% funded, but because the contributions are sufficient, as an actuary, that tells me that it should improve its funding status because it is on track to reach 100% funding by some date in the future. And so even though it's 60% today, it tells me the trend is upward, and I'd rather retire from Plan 2 with the information that's available to me. So that's the conclusion of my presentation, and I am happy to answer any additional questions you might have.
Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Wurst? All right, thank you very much, and we appreciate you coming here tonight.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear from Howard Bicker, the Executive Director of the State Board of Investment.
Hey, Howard.
Welcome to the Pension Commission 2013, Mr. Bicker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the Director of the State Investment Board. We're passing around a very short presentation. I was told to be very brief. The first page of the presentation shows the board. The board is comprised of the governor, the state auditor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state. That is established by the Constitution. From an investment advisory council standpoint, the board has a council that advises both the staff and the board on various investment-related policy. This is a 17-member council, which is delineated by statute. 10 of the members are from the local investment community, the people who run the pensions at 3M and Target and Cargill and so on and so forth serve on this advisory council. The directors of the three retirement systems, the commissioner of finance, excuse me, management budget, I'm old, it's still commissioner of finance for me, and then the governor appoints two active employees and one retiree, and I have a staff of 22 people. Page three is a summary of the assets under management as of June 30th. At that point, the board was responsible for $62.3 billion. The majority of the assets at this point, $47.5 billion, are for the combined funds or the funds for the defined benefit plan. We also run the supplemental investment funds, which is a group of mutual fund type investments that are used by a number of entities, including volunteer fire relief associations. We are responsible for the investments of the state's deferred comp plan. We do other non-retirement issues like the assigned risk plan, which is part of the workers' comp system. We do the permanent school fund, the environmental trust fund, and a number of miscellaneous funds, plus the state's general revenue fund and highway funds. On page five is our long-term objectives. Our long-term objectives is over 20 years to provide a real rate of return and also to beat a composite index. You can see on page six, over long returns, we have outperformed inflation, so we've provided real rates of return. On page seven is investment numbers. And as all you, as many of you are aware, the markets have been volatile over the last few years. We went through 08 and 09, where we kept people away from tall buildings and open windows. But things have improved. You can see that over longer periods of time, we have done well enough to exceed the assumed rates of return. Over the last 20 years, we have done 8.2%. Since 1-1 of 1980, back as far as we have good clean records, which is 32 and a half years, we have compounded at 9.9%. Madam Chair and members, it's a very quick overview of the State Investment Board. I'd like to respond to any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Bicker? Okay, I'm sure we'll see you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Next, Mr. Martin. Are we going to do the...
Yes, members. I'm going to talk about the elements and the terminology that we use in our defined benefit plans. And I've got the various slides are in your packets. If you turn to page two, the first slide. What I've done here is given you a basic definition of the term or a phrase that is applicable. And then I've also included in the greenish portion, if there's a principle of pension policy that has something to do with this particular topic, I've given you that particular principle. In your packets, if you've dug through them a bit, there's a folder in there called Standard Packet Items, and in there there's a pink-colored item, which is the principles of pension policy all put together in one place. So if you like looking at these in parts, then that this is presenting it to you in parts. If you like it all together, it's all together in that.
Just a minute, Mr. Martin. So Representative Murphy, these principles were actually adopted before I even came on the Pension Commission. So... you were involved in the process of adopting the principles?
Madam Chair, we were, when I was chair, we looked over the principles that were established long before I became chair.
Wow.
And we went through them and revised them or made changes. And at that particular time, most of the members did fully understand them and know them.
So, members, I just want to ask you to commit this to memory. You know, it is kind of a tradition and a culture in the Pension Commission that we do look at the principles to help guide us in our decision making. And if we're, you know, if we're differing from the principles, then maybe we need to revisit the principles or we need to revisit the policy. But it does help us to be consistent in what we do with pension law. So, and Mr. Martin is going to refer to them throughout his presentation. Before you continue, Mr. Martin, I forgot I wanted to welcome Representative O'Driscoll. You missed our first meeting. And did you want to just say a few words about yourself?
Representative O'Driscoll, happy to be here. Don't want to take Mr. Martin's time, so.
All right. All right, well, thank you very much for joining us. Mr. Martin.
The principles, to just put a high note on those, the Pension Commission has been around since the mid-1950s, and the principles were first developed in the late 50s and have been handed on and periodically looked at by the Pension Commission. Senator Johnson's husband, former Representative Jefferson, was another chair who spent a fair amount of time looking at and reviewing the principles and updating them. Slide 2 gives you the basic difference between defined benefit and defined contribution plans. Ms. Wurst was talking about the funding of defined benefit plans and was not talking about defined contribution plans. Most of our Minnesota pension plans are defined benefit plans. And what you're really looking at is what factor is going to be fixed and what factor is going to become a variable. In a defined benefit plan, the benefit that's being paid out is specified in some manner, usually a formula. What becomes the variable then is the funding for that promised benefit. Defined contribution is the flip side, the contributions, the income stream, the money that's going into the plan is fixed. The benefit becomes whatever pot of gold would exist for that particular employee. Defined contribution plans are typically 401k plans, IRA, individual our retirement plans, deferred comp plans. So it's a basic distinction. Page 3 gives you a list of our defined benefit plans. Page 4 is a list of the defined contribution plans, so just to give you some flavor for our plans and the type. Another key distinction, and this is on page 5, is there Social Security or isn't there Social Security as part of the overall pension coverage of our public employees? Some of our plans are alternatives to Social Security. We typically call those, at least in the general employee setting, basic programs. When we provide a benefit that supplements Social Security, the phrasing here in Minnesota is coordinated programs, at least in the general employee plans. Our correctional plans also supplement Social Security rather than replace it. For our public safety plans, by both federal and state law, they're excluded from Social Security coverage, and their only pension coverage is the public employee pension plan that you folks oversee. The employee type also drives distinctions in the principles and in what will happen during the course of the session. We draw general distinctions between public safety employees and general employees. And the public safety plans are typically without Social Security coverage, and they provide a larger benefit at an earlier age based on the nature of the police or fire work that's being performed by those employees. Page 7 gives you a full set of the elements that are defined in your packet. I'm going to stop at about halfway through this because I want to mostly cover the first half of them, and if time permits, we can get further, but I think that may give you a sense of what's going on. So slide 8 has to do with membership. Most but not all Minnesota public employees are members of a public employee plan. In part, historically, the way pension plans have been created in the state is they were added on periodically as in groups of employees requested or demanded that they be covered by pension plans. That incremental way of doing things will inherently leave some people out. There are other folks who are left out because their service is so infrequent or intermittent that it doesn't make sense to provide them pension coverage. In most of our public pension plans, the participation in the pension plan is a mandatory item. It's a condition of employment from day one. The employee, dollar one, is covered by a public employee pension plan. One of the key plans that doesn't do this is PERA, which does exclude members who do not earn a significant enough salary. $425 in any month is the break point, and it's been that break point for a period of time. Another key concept, and this is slide 9, is the notion of the allowable service credit. Allowable service credit is really the thing of value that the employee gets in, or one of the primary things of value that a public employee gets in the defined benefit plan. Because the formula that we use takes service credit and applies that against an average final average salary with a formula per year of service. There are two things here. Allowable service credit can be obtained either concurrent with employment, that is, as you serve a year of service, you get a year of service credit, or by prior service credit purchases. And folks who got missed for some reason, folks who think that they have service that should be considered public service will sometimes request the opportunity to purchase prior service to wave the magic wand and provide them with a service history that they should have had in their estimation but didn't have. Vesting requirements is on page 10. This is the length of time in our systems that you need to render in order to gain a non-forfeitable entitlement to a retirement annuity or a retirement benefit. Some plans historically, long ago, used to have age and service requirements to vest. Minnesota has at least not in the last half century or more utilized age as part of the vesting. We're totally a service-driven vesting requirement state. There are two types of vesting that are laid forth there. Cliff vesting, this is all-or-nothing vesting. So you are 100% vested when you hit a certain level of service. If you're short of that level of service, you have zero vesting, zero right to a retirement annuity from that plan. And then there's graduated vesting. A lot of our volunteer fire plans use this. Some of our public employee plans after the 2010 benefit changes also use graduated vesting where a year of service will get you some fraction of the what otherwise would be the full cliff vesting, 100%, and you scale up as you get more service credit. Another thing that another part of the defined benefit plan that an employee earns as they go through the system is covered salary. We utilize a system that applies the formula to a salary base, and so that what is in that covered salary is very, very important. It's the salary base that's used for both determining contributions and the retirement annuity. In Minnesota, we use final average salary, and in almost all cases, that's what's called the high five, the highest five average years, average successive years formula. The next item is the benefit accrual or formula percentage rates. This is the part of the formula where each year of service credit is worth something, and typically in our plans, it's worth a certain percentage of that final average salary. The benefit is payable at a certain point. And slide 13 talks about normal retirement ages. Normal is when is not doesn't mean that you are abnormal if you draw it at a different date. It's references the point in time when an employee has the earliest entitlement to a full benefit, unreduced for early retirement. And I've given you a number of the normal retirement ages that we have roaming around in our systems. For general employees who were hired before 1989, we have the rule of 90 benefit tier. This is when age and service credit together totals or exceeds the sum of 90. Whatever that age is, you can retire with the benefits. The level benefit tier uses an age 65 or age 66 normal age for retirement. For some pre-89 general employee plan members, age 62 with 30 years of service is also applicable. Then for public safety and for correctional plans, age 55 is the typical normal retirement age. Early retirement age is simply what it says, an age early than the normal age. Typically, some sort of reduction is imposed for an individual who retires early. The reduction can be either a full actuarial reduction, meaning that the value of the benefit paid early is reduced so that the total payout is going to have the same actuarial value, the same present value of benefits as the benefit would have had at the normal retirement age. And in some cases, we subsidize early retirement. We provide a reduction that's smaller than what would be needed to keep everything actuarially the same liability and the same value. And that emphasizes or encourages, obviously, early retirement. Our benefits, our formulas that are set forth in statute are single life retirement annuities. This means that it's payable only for the life of the retiree. That's how it's first computed. Page 16 talks about the our retirement annuity forms. We do permit, although we calculate the benefit as a single life annuity, we do permit and indeed mandate in some instances that it be paid under an optional a retirement annuity form. Representative Nelson was the chief author of the item talked about on page 616. For married pension plan members, unless the second spouse, the second life on the account waives it, individuals receive an automatic, they automatically get a reduction and they receive a 50% joint and survivor benefits. Joint survivor benefits are defined on slide 17. This is the optional form which allows an individual to convert their single life annuity into a benefit that's payable to them and then to a survivor to be named as part of the benefit election, and that the portion of the benefit that would be payable to the survivor can be 100%, 75%, 50%, or 25% in our systems. Not all plans utilize the full gamut. And so the individual takes a reduction in their benefit in order to provide this survivor insurance-type coverage to provide a benefit for someone that they consider important, and to make sure that they get a portion of the benefit should the prime retiree predecease. Other optional annuity forms that we have are the accelerated optional annuity form. This allows somebody to receive a larger portion of their benefit, a larger amount of their benefit for a period of time in the early years of our retirement, and then have it scaled back to a smaller amount later. These started off as trying to level against Social Security benefits for individuals who retire prior to the receipt of Social Security. So if you retired at age 60, you couldn't draw Social Security until age 62. You would want to take a larger benefit for a couple of years to even out so that your total take over time would be somewhat the same. The other kinds are term certains. If you're concerned that you might die before you drew out your full value. You can take a term certain. You're buying the commitment of the pension plan to pay this benefit for your lifetime, but in no event less than a certain number of years. The guaranteed refund is true only really for a TRA, which doesn't provide automatically a refund as part of its single life annuity, and it is an option in a TRA. Page 19, I try and give you a benefit computation for someone who would be the typical TRA coordinated program member right now, a hypothetical teacher, and lay out what that hypothetical demographic situation is on the top of the page, and run through the normal our retirement calculation for you and the early our retirement calculation for you to give you a sense of what happens if the teacher stays until normal our retirement 66 or retires early at 55. So you can see where the steps are and how that happens. The balance of the presentation, maybe we should. Supplemental pension plan coverage is page 20. We typically provide opportunities for deferred comp, other member-funded supplemental benefits, and there also are a few supplemental pension plans that do provide an additional benefit to a public pension plan member. Minsky employees have a college supplemental plan, something that dates out of the late 60s. Hennepin County also in the late 60s set up a supplemental pension plan that provides an additional benefit for plan members. Deferred retirement annuities and augmentation is on page 21. If someone has enough service in to vest but terminates employment before they hit the normal age for retirement or an early retirement age, and they choose not to take a benefit, they want to wait until normal retirement age, they're considered to be a deferred retiree, and we provide the benefit when they do apply at our retirement age, and we also typically augment. We increase that benefit for the period of the deferral, so it keeps closer to the same purchasing value as the benefit I would have if they had not deferred, to keep the benefit current. The other item dealt with on this slide is the reemployed annuitant earnings limits. Our plans have imposed limits when individuals draw an annuity and are reemployed with an employer covered by the same pension plan. So a retired teacher who comes back to teaching is going to run into the reemployed annuitant earnings limits potentially. A teacher who would go and work for DNR and work for the state of Minnesota would not run into the same earnings limitations. A retiring teacher who goes to work in the private sector would not run into the limitations. So the limitations are fund specific. We key off of the Social Security system, so there is no earnings limitation for once an individual turns age 65. We use the earnings test of Social Security, and before 65, it's in the neighborhood of $14,000 or $15,000 before they kick in. On page 22, we're talking about casualty coverage here. The key point here is probably with disabilities and the difference between how you define what a disability is, what job do you look at. For our public safety plans, we use an occupationally based disability definition. That we're looking at whether the individual can do their duties as a police officer or a firefighter. Hence, you can have a disabled police officer if they lose motion in their trigger finger. In our general employee pension plans, it's a total and permanent disability. You're incapable of any gainful employment. So a more rigorous, a more difficult disability to receive a disability benefit in a general employee plan. Typically, our disability benefits are the normal retirement benefit payable at the time of disability without an early retirement reduction. And there also is survivor casualty coverage in our pension plans, in particular our public safety plans. Historically, when the state coordinated with Social Security back in the 50s, we did away with a lot of the prior survivor coverage, but over time, portions of the survivor coverage have been added to our plans. Slide 23 talks about portability. Portability is when you move from one plan to another plan. We do provide within our Minnesota public pension system overall portability. So individuals who are public employees at the state level and then move to local government level, who shift from being a state trooper to being an elementary school teacher or whatever, have a couple of different ways of putting together their time and ultimately qualifying and receiving a pension benefit. The service in more than one plan provision is an older portability mechanism, doesn't use the common high five, but does tack time together, allows individuals with a sufficient period of service to vest in any one of the plans, rendered over a couple or more plans, to be able to vest and to draw a benefit. The combined service annuity is another portability provision, came through in the mid-1970s, uses a common high five, gives you a more complete benefit. Similar for disability and survivor benefits, we have a portability mechanism. Slide 24 has to do with post-retirement adjustment mechanisms. We do provide post-retirement increases. We used to, before 2009, provide them based in part or in whole based on the investment performance of the pension plan. That's not the way Minnesota does post-retirement increases. Now we provide typically a percentage increase per year. Those have been modified in 2010 in many cases, most cases. But there are increases that typically occur when an individual does retire annually for the period of that service or that retirement. Then the last slide, slide 2025, refunds and repayment of refunds. If an individual does not vest or if they want their member contribution rather than a pension benefit, which is rarely an economically sound thing to do, we do provide for refunds of accumulated member contributions plus interest. If a person who has terminated and taken a refund is reemployed and works a minimum period of time after receipt or after returning to active service, we do typically permit members to repay past refunds with interest. Members, that perhaps gives you some sense about the various elements in our pension plan, some of the terminology when it comes to the plan provision side of the benefit coverage question.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. That was excellent. And I especially like that you put the principles that were applicable on each page. Are there any questions from members of the commission?
Madam Chair.
Senator Webster Benson.
I love the promotion every time I come here.
It's a demotion.
The last slide, the first bullet, refund of accumulated member contributions, would that be a refund that would include both what the member donated, or not donated, but contributed, and what the employer?
No.
Mr. Martin.
The refund, representative, is just the accumulated member contributions. The employer contributions are not refundable in our systems. If an individual does take a refund, that does provide typically a gain to the pension plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a turnover or withdrawal gain, and it does get factored into the actuarial assumptions. So we do look at the experience of the plan in people who leave early, leave without sufficient time to vest, and who take a refund.
One follow-up, please.
Please, Representative Benson.
Can someone who is in a plan that would be law enforcement, that's not going to get Social Security, can they take a refund? I'm sensing that there would be a limitation on a refund to contributions. If you had somebody in the correctional facilities or a policeman, for example, that's in the system, works for 5 years, and takes a refund in that 5 year period, they wouldn't have contributed to Social Security either. So, how does that work? I mean, would they have to refund, have to pay into Social Security for that 5 year period?
Question.
No.
No, Representative. The nature of your employment governs whether or not you have Social Security coverage. And if you are in public safety in Minnesota, you don't have Social Security coverage for that period. Should you take a refund, you would have no coverage for that five-year period.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Martin, just to pursue a little bit and for clarification purposes, what Representative Benson was talking about, do new law enforcement officers, and I use that term in quotes, participate in the basic or coordinated plan?
Mr. Martin.
New law enforcement members are in a basic program. They're only covered by the public employee pension plan. If we're talking about police officers and firefighters, and in the case of Hennepin County, the Hennepin County EMTs are also considered firefighters for Social Security purposes. Correctional employees in the state facilities or local jailers are not considered public safety employees for Social Security purposes, are covered by Social Security.
Follow-up, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the correctional employees would be an MSRS, correct? And police and fire would be PERA.
The state employees who are working in a correctional facility, if they have sufficient inmate contact, and this would be probably 60-70% of the workforce perhaps, would have sufficient contact to be in the MSRS correctional plan. The other individuals who work in a prison but do not have enough inmate contact to merit the hazardous pension benefit coverage that the our correctional plan provides would be in the MSRS general plan.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Martin? Okay, the final thing on our agenda is just to allow the public pension plan administrators to introduce themselves, say a little bit about the type of employees they cover, and maybe you could tell us if you're going to have legislation before us to this this session. So let's start with Mr. Stoffel from the Duluth Teacher Retirement Fund. Welcome to the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Good evening. My name is, well, according to the agenda, J. Michael Stoffel, but please call me Jay. I've been the executive director for Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund for 21 years. I moved to Duluth at that time. It's been a great place to live and raise a family. It was a great decision. Prior to that, I was finance manager at PERA for 4 years under Jim Hacking and Lori Hacking. Prior to that, I was one of your employees at the Office of the Legislative Auditor, working for Jim Nobles and briefly for Eldon Store, if that name maybe for some of you rings a bell. That's my history. I love working for Duluth Teachers. They're a great group of people. My fund covers, well, the Duluth Teacher Pension Fund covers the certified staff of the ISD 709. The non-certified staff are in PERA. So I've got the teachers, the educators, the administrators in ISD 709. We have a history of being a relatively very healthy fund relative to the funds in Minnesota and around the country. Very strong history of very strong funding. We're proud of that. But we will have legislation this year because we are in a difficult situation. It's unfamiliar territory for us. We're 60% funded on a market value basis, and that doesn't feel good. We've got an 8% deficiency. I've been talking to many of you today and yesterday. I still have to make a few more visits, but we will be proposing some legislation for a solution to that challenging issue.
Okay, thank you very much. Welcome. Any questions? All right, well, I'm sure we'll see more of you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bergstrom from MSRS.
Good evening. We did give a handout for all of the statewide funds Just a colored sheet.
My
name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I've been the director since 1992. Prior to that, I worked for 8 years at PERA. The chart just shows the plans that we cover. We cover state employees, University of Minnesota non-faculty, Met Council, Historical Society. So just to explain the chart, and then I won't go through all of the numbers. Across the general plan, that's the largest plan we administer, we have $9.1 billion worth of assets. Active participants is self-explanatory. Benefit recipients would be people retired, disabled, or survivors. And then deferred vested would be people who are no longer with the system but someday will be eligible for pension. So they have enough years to qualify but have not yet collected, so they're no longer in the program. So as you go down then the left, we administer the general plan, correctional plan, the state patrol plan, the judge's plan, the legislator's plan, which was closed in 1997, elective state officer's plan in 1997 was closed. We administer the unclassified plan, which you are members of, your staff are members of that plan. And we also administer some voluntary plans. We administer the Minnesota State Deferred Compensation Plan that is available to not just state employees, but city, county, school district employees, any public employee in Minnesota. The same is true of the Health Care Savings Plan. That is a voluntary plan used to cover health care costs and available to any public employee in Minnesota. And then we administer a supplemental plan for Hennepin County. Legislatively, we have a bill to fund the state patrol plan, a bill to fund the judge's retirement plan, and then we also have an administrative bill that we will be bringing forward.
Okay. Any questions? Senator, Representative Benson. It's going to take me a while. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did met with the judges just last week, and they presented their plan. Would it be the same plan that then you'd be coming forward with that their council recommended?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Benson, it is the same plan. I worked with the District Judges Association. And, okay. Yep.
Great. Thank you.
And if you notice, there are 34 legislators that are still active participants, and that's probably Representative Murphy and myself. You're still with Defined Benefit?
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I bet it's Representative Kahn. Of course you would be. You're on the Pension Commission.
Yeah. Four is prior to the 2012
election. 12 election?
Yes, because of July.
Right, so some people have left. This is 2012 data.
Yep, this is June 30th, so we're probably in the neighborhood of 24, 25 active legislators.
Oh, because of all the retirements?
Yes.
Wow. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mary Vanek from Public Employees Retirement Association.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mary Most Vanek. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement Association. I have been with PERA since January of 1975 and have been director since January of 1997. So I've been fortunate the board entrusted me with that responsibility. We are the largest in terms of members and assets, but we cover a lot of part-time folks in cities and counties and school districts, which does explain why we have such a large population in our plan. Our general plan is our largest, currently at a little over $13 billion, with about 140,000 active members and 75,000 benefit recipients. Our police and fire plan is our next largest, with just under $6 billion in assets and another close to 11,000 active members and 9,400 benefit recipients. That number went up significantly because of the merger of the Minneapolis Police and Fire Relief Associations the end of 2011. We also have a correctional plan that you gave to us in 1999 to cover local government correctional officers. So there are about 67 facilities in the counties around the state who have officers who are covered by this plan, about 3,500 members. And we have a defined contribution plan we've been administering for primarily local government elected officials, city council, school board, county commissioners. There are some volunteer ambulance services in there, but mainly it is local government elected officials who participate in that plan. And then in 2010, you asked us to take over the administration of the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, MRF. That is still a separate account under the umbrella of our general plan. And if it gets to 80% funded, then it will be merged with our larger plan and be part of that plan going forward. Any questions?
Any legislation?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair. Yes, you're going to see a lot of paralegislation this year. We have introduced about six bills. At least half of them are technical correction bills. Our largest one we've talked to most of you about is the Police and Fire Fund, where, as Ms. Wurst explained earlier, the money coming in and the money going out are out of balance, so we need to get those back in balance, and we'll be doing that with the provisions that are being recommended in this bill.
Any questions? All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Vanek. Next, Mr. Dond from the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund.
Thank you, Madam President and members of the Commission. My name is Paul Doan, and I have the privilege of serving as the Executive Director of the St. Paul Teacher Retirement System. I am in my second year here in Minnesota, and I'm more impressed with the winter this year than I was last year.
You just had that big storm in Massachusetts.
Well, that's true.
Lucky to be here.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
St. Paul Teachers has operated since 1909 with a very rich and cherished history of providing services and benefits to the certified teachers within the St. Paul School District. We have a 10-member board of trustees. Nine of those are elected, retired, or active members, and one is appointed by the school board. We counted to some of the earlier presenters here. We do have an investment portfolio that the board is responsible for of about a little over $900 million, as well as dealing with the benefits and member services. As I mentioned, the system has been paying benefits since 1910. The first benefit paid was around $200, but a total of about $5,000 was paid out in 1910 to some 15 recipients at that time. Today we have about 3,000 retired members receiving benefits, and this past year for the first time it exceeded $100 million in annual benefit payments. I provided a summary page of some details about the system, but in basic sense, we have 10,000 members of the system. Roughly 3,000 are retired. A little over 3,000 are so-called inactive or unvested, and about 3,800 members are active teachers. We have a funded ratio of around 62% at this time, and we will be having legislation before the commission this session to deal with a rather a broad set of issues that the board feels it needs to act upon. Some of them involve contributions. Some of them involve some state assistance. Some of them involve modifications to certain programs within our system in terms of operating efficiency. So it will be a rather comprehensive package, and we look forward to working with you on that package in this next session.
Mr. John, I made that joke about Massachusetts, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background.
Thank you, Madam President. I have been here for 2 years. Prior to that, I was retired more than once, I guess, in this life. I spent much of my career in New York as an investment manager, and as a matter of fact, that was my initial association with St. Paul Teachers as a manager for one of their investment managers for the system back in the 1990s. I have served as a regulator with respect to running the Massachusetts system. I served as Howard Bicker's sort of a counterpart in Massachusetts, running their investment portfolio under Bill Weld, Governor Weld's administration. Later served as a commissioner under Governor Romney in the public employee retirement system. Spent 18 years in New York with an investment manager and squeezed somewhere through all of that. I had the privilege of serving four terms as a senator in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So it's been an opportunity to deal both, and also I've been the director of the retirement system, the teachers' retirement system in Arkansas, in addition to the Prim Fund in Massachusetts, and now serving here in St. Paul. So it's been a varied background in terms of both a legislator, elected official, a regulator, administrator, and an investment manager. So I've seen seen the pension community from all sides of the fence. And I'm delighted to be here. My wife and I absolutely love it here in St. Paul.
Thank you. And that's more than I actually knew about you, so thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Doan? Okay, and then we have Lori Hacking from the Teachers Retirement Plan.
Madam Chair, Lori Hacking with Teachers Retirement, and I'm the backside of the page that Dave and Mary spoke from. My background is I've been lucky enough to spend my nearly 40-year career in pensions, last 20 of them directing systems here in Minnesota and in Ohio, and I've been with Teachers Retirement Association for about 7 years. TRA, as you can see from this sheet, covers K through 12 public school teachers and administrators, with the exception of St. Paul and Duluth, which are they're in separate funds. We also cover charter school teachers, and state university, community college faculty have the option to participate in TRA, and they also have another option for a retirement plan, so it's optional for their participation with us. Our assets as of last year were $16.7 billion. We're now, I'm glad to say, we're up close to $18 billion because the market has been very kind to us in the last few months. We have over 76,000 active members, over 53,000 benefit recipients, and 38,000-plus deferred members. With respect to this coming session, we will have one bill which is targeted on recommending some alternative early retirement reduction factors. It's kind of a technical issue, but that will be the main bill that we will bring forward. Our funding ratio currently is 72.5%. We're watching that very closely. It's not a comfortable position that we're in. Our board is watching it closely, and we may have some recommendations next session, not this session. So,
any questions for Ms. Hacking? All right. We forgot to talk about one more. Okay, members, we did discuss last time we met about this being our regular meeting time, Tuesdays at 5:30. So I hope that you've set it aside on your calendar, because we have bills introduced now so we can start hearing them. Any questions for any members? Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one thing I want to point out is I had the benefit in the House Government Operations Committee to hear a little bit more detailed presentations from all of the different directors. Mm-hmm. And I think that soon it would be in the committee's best and the commission's best interest to see the liability side of the asset structure that we have here, because as was pointed out by a few of the directors, some are trending very dangerously close to that 70% or less mark, and that's something that I think that we want to put in front of the commission members as quickly as possible. As we did here, they do have some correction bills that they'd like to bring forward, and not that I'm sounding any alarm bells specifically, but the color coding has changed from the forest fire is not green, but it's not red either. It's somewhere in between. So,
well, and Mr. O'Driscoll, since we've had the downturn in the market, the plans have come forward before to adjust the contribution levels and the benefit levels, and I think that's an ongoing project until we're on the correct path. So we will be doing that.
Senator Pappas.
Yes, Representative Benson.
Yeah, just and to add on to that, I would appreciate, and I know a couple of the plans have already included it in the information that I've gotten. I'd like to see a trend line, at least a 10-year trend line, on their contribution levels, if I could.
Okay. Everybody hear that? All right. We can ask them to do that. Would you like that ahead of time or just when they present their bills?
I actually like it ahead of time.
Okay.
And if we could get them electronically, that would be great.
Okay. I think if they get that to Mr. Martin, he can send it out too. And Lisa, blanked on your last name.
Dieslin.
And Ms. Dieslin can send it out to all the members of the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other comments, requests? My request is that you come eat some more food. And I'll see you next week. Meeting is adjourned.